This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Bill Murray. In the Washington Post, reporter Hal Hinson wrote about him. In the movies, Murray is a symbol of everything slothful and unhealthy. He slouches when he walks, mumbles when he talks. He's unscrupulous and cynical and downright strange, the poster child for wretched excess and insincerity. Bill Murray stars in the new film, What About Bob? He plays another overbearing character, a neurotic guy with lots of phobias. He finds a new psychiatrist, played by Richard Dreyfuss, but it's August, and the doctor is leaving town to vacation with his family. Murray feels he can't face his phobias alone, so he tracks down the family, and when he finds them, he just won't go away. This character is truly unbearable. I asked Bill Murray the trick to making a character like that lovable at the same time.
I have that problem in my life. That's generally the problem. Of getting away with whatever I'm doing. So I have practice in this area. I'm rehearsed and trained in this area. But you're right, this was a kind of hard job in that it did get annoying. I mean, and the part was maybe a little overwritten in the annoying area. So I had to change some things, make things less annoying always, and to eliminate some things.
What did you change?
Well, I changed a lot of things. I mean, that's my job, is to take what writers write and change it. I'm just saying that for any potential writers out there to avoid me in the future.
But you might be warned, yeah.
It's what, you know, it's sort of, the writing is just is often general because the physical reality is always different than what a writer can imagine, or it's often different than what a writer imagines. So something that seems sort of just the right amount of annoying on the printed page, depending upon how the previous scenes have been shot or demonstrated, you know, certain areas get washed out, you know. They get cleaned out, you know. And if you milk a certain kind of annoyance that is too close to the way the next scene is written annoyance-wise, you have to change it. So you're constantly trying to make it less annoying so it'll be palatable. Because you can always turn up the annoyance level. And you want to save it. You want to pick your shot for when the other person needs more annoyance. So,
are directors or screenwriters ever offended when you want to change the lines or improvise on the lines?
Well, not any of the ones that I've worked with yet. Generally, if you want to change the line and improve the line, they like it. I know that some writers I worked with, I changed a lot of lines, and now they get paid a fortune to write scripts. So they're they're really happy with the changes that I've made, and it makes them look good if it's good. It's when you change it completely in the essence of what the idea of what they wanted is changed that I think they get upset. But movies are a collaborative business, and I don't think there are only a handful of people that are expert at writing movies, and I don't consider myself one either. But having to play the stuff, I know that it always has to change and adjust because it's two languages. It's words and pictures.
Now, last year you co-directed Quick Change, which mm-hmm. you also starred in. Mm-hmm. Did you feel any different about improvisation when it was your movie? Did you want the actors to improvise, and did you improvise as much?
I don't think I improvised as much, but I think that's because I worked on the script a long time.
Right, so you didn't need to.
And I worked improv. No, I didn't need to as much. But there was one actor in our film, Tony Shalhoub, who played a cab driver who pretty much came in, and his part was unwritten. It was just everything was suggested, all what he was supposed to do, but there were no words because he invented this language, this sort of Middle Eastern language, to speak as this cab driver whom we can't understand and can't understand us. And so everything he did was a surprise, you know. So and he kills in the movie. He's really funny. I think it's one of the funniest performances I've seen in a long time. And there were several parts where what a director wants is somebody who will take what's on the page and bring more to it, you know. You can get a number of people who will come and do it exactly as it's written, but you want somebody who's going to bring more. That's when you really feel like, oh, what a good day it was today. This guy came in and just killed it and made it better than it was written.
My guest is Bill Murray, and he's starring in the new movie, What About Bob? Now, you've really made it in the entertainment industry, but you've also really perfected that kind of showbiz phony sincerity, which is kind of epitomized by the lounge singer that you used to do. I'd really love to hear when that kind of showbizy stuff started to really make an impression on you.
Well, when I really got deep into it, I mean, I think it probably was the Jerry Lewis telethon business that started. You start watching that telethon. I mean, it's not as great now as it was in the old days when Jerry was on like various maintenance programs and he would have mood swings in the course of the show. We used to have a club called the Sammy Club in New York, this friend of ours, Bob Tischler, and we would, several of us would go to his house to watch the Sammy and Company show. That's like the clearest example.
And what would you do when you watched it?
Well, first of all, he had a poster of Sammy that he would unroll and put on the wall. And then we'd just go crazy watching it, absolutely crazy. And sometimes if someone weren't with us, the phone would ring during the commercial and it would be someone who was, you know, sort of a honorary member of the club who wasn't there, who was, you know, out of town or something. And it would just be hysterical laughter of what had just happened during the last sequence. And then, of course, you'd hang up for the commercial. And the same thing would happen watching the Jerry Lewis telethon. I mean, you could actually, 5:30 in the morning, you could call someone, you know, and he'd pick up the phone and say, "I saw it." You know, because there were people who were monitoring the entire telethon, watching the stuff that Jerry was doing in the middle of the night.
Now, how old were you when you started, you know, obsessing on Jerry Lewis telethons and joining the Sammy Club?
Well, that was late. I mean, I don't want you to put me in any kind of a weird showbiz kid thing. That was later. I was an adult. I could vote and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't childhood.
Now, what was the TV that made the biggest impression on you when you were growing up? Did you watch a lot of it?
I guess I did. I mean, I watched it all. You know, people say, well, what were your influences? I could not identify an influence other than my family, you know. My brother Brian was probably my biggest influence, you know.
In what respect?
Well, I watched him on the stage a lot, and that's the Second City in Chicago. And,
right.
You know, I just saw, that was really my training. I didn't get much training from television. My father and my brother and my grandfather, my father was a very tough laugh, and then my brother was in a difficult guy to make laugh, and it had to be funny, it had to be good. And my brother was on the stage and with Harold Ramis and John Belushi and Joe Flaherty, and these guys were the funniest guys in America at that time, I thought. And I just watched them work, you know, almost every night on the stage and saw how they understood the rhythm of a live audience.
Yeah, well, your brother Brian Doyle Murray is, I think, 5 years older than you. Were you ever considered the hanger-on? Was he ever annoyed when you'd show up all the time?
No, I think he was a really good brother to me, you know. I mean, he was almost a father after my father died, so he was, you know, he was very good to me, and, you know, I think I owe him $200, but I mean, I think I owe him a lot and a lot of credit for whatever success I've had.
Did you start performing when he was doing Second City? Did you hang around long enough and make yourself known in such a way that you were invited to perform yourself?
Well, that's eventually what happened, yeah. And he came back. He'd gone out to California for a while to work, and he came back, and at one time we were in the same show together, which was kind of fun.
Now, at this point, when you were doing Second City, were you already into the kind of unctuous side of show business?
No, I wasn't good enough. I was still trying to perform the scenes that I was supposed to do well on the stage. That sort of thing just was starting. I mean, Joe Flaherty was a guy who was really big on that sort of stuff. And just cheap acting was a thing that we did a lot, you know.
Oh,
yeah. We were more interested in cheap acting. There was a great movie called South Sea Sinner with McDonald, Carey, and Frank Lovejoy that was like the cheapest thing you ever saw in your life. And you know, the big plot thing was the guy was accused of selling crude rubber to the Japanese. You know, I mean, it was just the nuttiest, goofy movie. And the cutaways of this tiny model boat tossing at sea and having to perform surgery at sea with just a bottle of whiskey and a knockout punch and stuff like that. Really cheap stuff. And that was about as close we got to bad show business at that time.
In talking about bad movies and bad acting, was that already under your skin, or did you have to learn how to do that really bad reaction shot, you know?
Well, once it's been identified, then it's immediate. It's like once you spot a cancer cell, then it's very clear what they look like, and that sort of was the same thing. There wasn't much to learning with it. Once you see it and you identify it, then it was as easy. I mean, I could do bad acting for the rest of my life. Only bad acting, as it is now, I just try to, I just try to avoid it. But I could just do only it, and many, many kinds of bad acting. I feel like once you get in, it's like a cult, you know, they give you all the secrets as soon as you walk in the door.
Does it ever get in the way of a real performance? You know, do you ever have to suppress the really bad acting moves and let genuine, you know, more subtle acting take over?
Well, that's a funny question because, like in this movie, what about Bob? I play a guy who's annoying, you know, so at any time I can be doing, you know, Dick Van Patten or any kind of, like, I can be doing anybody that's annoyed me or you know, I can be doing anybody. I think, oh, God, there's a way to say this that's really annoying, and I look at it and I go, who was that, you know? Because it's somebody who has annoyed me or has been annoying in a certain thing. Whining. Sometimes you do that whining thing. There's a lot of whining, but you've got to always step back from it. It is a bit of a problem. You do a scene and you go cut, and it goes, sorry, too much, you know? It was just, and it would be literally, you know, fill in the blank of someone you really hate, and it would be someone you could identify practically.
Bill Murray is my guest, and he's starring in a new movie called What About Bob? Now, in the movie Tootsie, I think you improvised a lot of this role, but you played a very self-involved, kind of experimental playwright. Did you know a lot of people like that in theater?
Self-involved?
Yeah, what could I possibly be thinking of?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I always... Guys whose art was so precious that it couldn't be explained to people, you know, really, and asking a question was like, oh, man, if you don't get it, you know, that kind of thing. It was always, I always enjoyed that, you know. I enjoyed meeting, like, people like that because it gave me an opportunity to unleash, you know, the darker side of my own wit upon them, you know. And you just wait, and you could sit with them for an hour and a half, and then finally there'd be that opening, and then you could just put a dagger right through their gut, you know. Because anyone that, you know, that attitude was just, it just invited trouble. But some of the things I said is that self-involved guy, I really do believe, you know. So it wasn't just totally, I was just being a drunk and obnoxious guy, but some of the things were really true, just like these guys that I would meet, you know, had some things to say.
Well, what's something that you said in Tootsie that you really believed in, but was also kind of funny and ironic at the same time?
I wanted to have a theater that was only open when it rained.
You genuinely did?
Yeah. Well, I said that in the movie. Oh. I said I wanted to have a theater that's only open when it rains. And I believe that from my own experience in the theater, that the best audience you could ever have even was not a full house, but a house that was three quarters full because of a very bad, or half full because of a very bad storm, which had kept people away, and they hadn't bothered to come, and they would come in still shaking the water off their shoulders and their heads and their hats, and they'd still be wet. Their hair would be wet on the back of their neck. Because it grounded them in a reality. It made them it put them on the planet. They weren't dreaming. They were really on the planet. So they were ready. the ideal specimens. They lived here, you know.
If you're just joining us, Bill Murray is my guest, and he's starring in a new movie called What About Bob? We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Murray is my guest, and he's starring in a new movie called What About Bob? You actually started performing when you were in high school, right?
Well, everybody did, didn't they? I mean, no. I performed in high school just to get out of class. You know, that was the thing. You auditioned for a show, and you would get certain hours off in the afternoon and not have to do homework and, you know, be excused from certain things. Actually, at my school, it was a boys' school. There were girls in these shows, so you could get out, and you even got to rehearse at night, which was really insane.
So, musicals? What did you get to be in?
Well, that was The Music Man was the big one, because it was great because we had to rehearse for months to learn all these dance numbers and vocal numbers, and to work with girl dancers from Sacred Heart. You know, the high school girls, and these were like rich girls from downtown who drank, you know, like gin out of 7-Up bottles and stuff. So. That was the best job I ever had, I think.
Well, I'm trying to imagine you. You were a dancer in The Music Man?
Yes, I was a dancer.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine you dancing in the chorus of a high school musical.
They wanted somebody who was big enough to lift up this one girl dancer, and they couldn't. The other people that auditioned, I walked by, and the auditions were going on, and there were a couple of very pretty girls in there, so I just walked in there, and they said, you. you know, and I literally just did it just to see what was going on. And I was like the biggest guy by about 5 inches. So they said, you're going to pick up the big girl, you know. And she was big. You know, I had to pick her up on my shoulder. She was large. It was just typecasting. It could have been Lou Ferrigno got the job. You know, he would have, yeah. Lou Ferrigno, you're a dancer? Yes, I am, you know, at once. I mean, it was really all about getting somebody up on your shoulders. But I don't regret it. Yes, I was a dancer, Terry. Yes. And I still go out and dance every once in a while, although I don't do it on the Broadway stage.
Oh, I just know High School Musicals had just the corniest choreography.
Well, actually, ours was just the rote one that came with the Music Man book. It wasn't bad. It was pretty good. So we were sort of doing pretty much the Shapoopy number from the musical.
Let me ask you a couple of things about Saturday Night Live. You joined after Chevy Chase left. Had you auditioned for the first round of the show?
Mm-hmm.
Your brother got in as a writer and you didn't. Was that very upsetting?
Well, he didn't really get in at that time as a writer.
Oh, he didn't? I'm sorry.
Was it upsetting not to get that job? Well,
yeah.
I didn't know what it was. We were all auditioning. Everybody was auditioning for this job. We were in this National Lampoon show, and, you know, Lorne Michaels and Tom Schiller came around and looked at the show. They saw the show 3 times. And we were all sort of in the, you know, whatever, the finals, the semifinals or something. And I knew they were going to pick some people, and they like every once in a while you'd hear, oh, they picked so-and-so, you know, somebody. And then we were offered another job. My brother and Chris Guest, who I was working with on the Lampoon show, the radio show, and myself were offered another job on this show called Saturday Night Live with Howard Cosell. And they were you know, they hadn't picked anybody in the other show, and I didn't really know what was going to happen with that show, and I knew the odds of all of us getting that show were, you know, I don't know. So I guess we just sort of decided to take the other job. They just hadn't made up their minds, and so we just decided to take the other job. And I'm glad I did. I had a good time on the Cosell show. Was like a wonderful combination of nightmare and hysteria and hysterical stories. I have much better stories from the Cosell show than I have from Saturday Night Live.
Yes, well, tell one.
No. No, those are, you got to pay money and you have to buy me drinks to get those stories out. They're really, well, I don't know, there is the story about Shamu.
The killer whale?
Yes. We were supposed to go live to Shamu in San Diego. The producer of the show, the Cosell show, was Rune Arledge, and his thing was satellite switching in those days. And we were supposed to go to Shamu at one point later in the show, and Shamu was going to be ridden by Diana Nyad, the first woman to swim around Manhattan Island. This is kind of how the show got packaged. But opening in the show, we had LaBelle, who was red hot at the moment with Lady Marmalade and their big songs. So they were promised 2 shows and 2 songs, but just before air, they were told by Rune Arledge they were only going to get 1 song. And when they told them they were cutting the second down, they just said, mm-mm. And it was a great moment at the stage door where they said, LaBelle, 20 seconds, and just these 3 heads shaking their head, no way. And they just turned and walked to the street and got in their limousine and pulled away. So you could hear from, 200 feet away, you could hear Rune going, go to Shamu, go to Shamu! You know, kind of thing. So we got to go early out to Shamu in San Diego. You know, you're not even buying me a drink, and I'm telling you a great show business story. We got to go early to Shamu in San Diego. And there's Soupy Sales, who is like our host for the Shamu sequence, out there. And he's got to, you see him with the earpiece in his ear, and you see the words register on his face where they say, Soupy, you've got to fill 5 minutes. And the look of like terror and elation on his face. And Soupy starts, like, splashing water in his face. It was absolutely, he literally went so far as, I think, to pour a bucket of water on his head just to get laughs. Hey, what about this? Hey, you know, filling 5 minutes of time. Unfortunately, we have to see the rest of Shamu's act, which at that time was the bicentennial year, had 3 guys dressed as the fife player, the drummer, and the guy with the flag riding on Shamu. Standing on Shamu as he goes around the pool at around 30 miles an hour. But then we've got to go back later in the show for Diana Nyad being the first woman to ride a killer whale. Well, we've already seen, like, the bicentennial poster standing on this whale, doing about 30 in full costume with the tricornered hats on. And when they gently lowered Diana Nyad onto the killer whale, you know, with the harnesses and this whole baloney and handlers, and I think they even had guys with guns or something, you know, in case the whale went berserk. You know, it was like a great melodrama thing, which was had all been killed by having to go to Shamu early. And the whale just sort of slowly pulled around the tank, very, very slowly, about 2 miles an hour. And Howard was going, Diana Nyad, riding the killer whale, the bravery of the woman. You know, riding and swimming in the Hudson River and the East River, you know, wasn't brave, but riding this whale at 1 mile an hour was.
This must have been the closest you got to really being in the kind of bad show business.
Yeah. It was really wonderful.
I guess it's a kind of like initiation rite everybody should go through who's in it, right, to be in like the real thing.
Well, it was a lot more fun than I imagined. I mean, Saturday Night Live was a lot of fun, and we used to go home and see their show because we'd be done, and we'd go home and see their show after that. But, you know, we had the advantage of being done, you know, and we could watch their show, and we'd have these great stories, far better than any stories they have from Saturday Night Live.
You must get offered a lot of roles now. How do you decide what you're going to take and what you're not going to, and what you think is just going to be duplicating what you've done, and what will be fun to do?
I wish I had a good answer to that one, Terry. Like, I throw them up the steps, whichever one goes the highest. I heard someone use that one once. I didn't think it was funny, but I think you just read them. There's so many of them that are the same. It's not that hard. It's not that hard. I mean, you go to the movies very much. I mean, there aren't very many of them that you like to watch, so you can imagine how many of them you'd like to be in for 3 months at a time.
Well, Bill Murray, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's been interesting, and I gave you that great story, so I guess you owe me a drink.
Right. Hey, next time we see each other.
Okay.
Yeah. My guest has been Bill Murray, and he stars in the new movie, What About Bob? I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.